Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're using. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. If you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, it's a warm one in southern New England. How's it down there?
Oh, it's hot again down here. We had a kind of a small lapse in the heat yesterday where the breeze came in and it rained for about 12 and a half minutes, and now we're back to hot again. So
yeah, we've actually had upper 90s.
Yeah.
Without the humidity the last few days. It's been a hot week. We got a couple sprinkles today, hoping for some more storms tonight, but they just kind of dance around us. It's just been hot, but what are you going to do? You got a good cup of coffee down there?
I do. I got my iced black silk.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. I found I'm going to use the phrase again, summer coffee, but I found a Hawaiian blend. I felt like that was kind of summery, and it's...
What's in the Hawaiian blend?
I have no idea. I was thinking maybe it was
tropical. Well, I know they grow coffee beans in Hawaii.
Yeah, but it's pretty good. It's still a little bit on the bitter side, which I love, but yeah, it's a good new addition to the cafe.
Always trying to have new drinks for
yeah, our you know, we got to spice up the menu a little bit. So I'm super excited about tonight's
Me
episode
too.
Because I feel like so many veterinary technicians, or you know, you teach now vet tech students, and I did for a little while myself, and I feel like so many want to ultimately go into Zoom Ed, and I don't know anything about it. It's not a career path I ever, you know, investigated, so I don't have a lot of good resources or information.
This was my dream job in college.
Yeah, I remember this was like your first job, right? Like yeah.
I did an internship at the Franklin Park Zoo up in Boston. So
yeah,
this is right up my alley.
Yeah, so so super excited to have Mark Romanowski come by the Vet Tech Cafe today. A credentialed veterinary technician and has been working at the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison, Wisconsin for the last few weeks. But prior to that, worked at the Oklahoma City Zoo and the Phoenix Zoo over the last few years. Got his start in zoo medicine by volunteering at the Phoenix Zoo and then ultimately was hired on full time. When he's not at the zoo... when not at the Phoenix Zoo, he worked at a specialty practice there in the surgery and anesthesia department and is working towards his VTS in zoo medicine. We'll talk about that. And he's also spoken at the Association of Zoo Veterinary Technicians annual conferences on the topics of stereotactic radiation in jaguars and most recently neuromuscular blocking agents and monitoring Western lowland gorillas undergoing laparoscopic surgery. Super
wow.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the other things, as we said in our last episode with Tabitha, Mark is also one of the 10 Vet Tech superstars to follow in DVM 360 magazine. If you don't already follow his Instagram page at ZoomEdRVT, definitely check it out. So many cool stories and facts about the animals that he's working with and different animals in the animal kingdom. And Dave, I'm a little bit proud of the Vet Tech Cafe because this is the fifth out of the 10 Vet Tech superstars that we've had. So that's pretty cool.
Maybe we can go through the rest of them.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. They're all a little bit different in different ways. Yeah. And we've got lots of great stuff to talk about with all of them. So definitely something to keep in the back of our minds. But anyway, Mark, what can we gift you for a cup of coffee? Thanks for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. What can we get to start you with?
Hey, I'm always been partial to a caramel frappuccino. I don't know. Kind of a wimpy coffee. But.
Not at all. When I lived in California, a caramel frap from Starbucks was for sure my go-to on the overnights. So I can absolutely relate. So we always kind of start with all of our guests kind of taking us through their career path because obviously in zoo medicine, probably a little bit different from a lot of people. So
this is going to be a lot different.
So kind of, you know, where you started all the way to where you are now, just take a few minutes and take us through that.
Yeah, sure. You're definitely right. It's totally different for everyone that's in zoo medicine. But I started, I got my associates in veterinary technology in 2013. And while I was in school, I worked at a Banfield, and then I did Banfield during the day and then went to school at night. So I really got to practice the things I was learning in real time, which was really nice. And then once I graduated, I stayed at Banfield for a few more years after I got my CVT license. And then I was like, you know, this is great. I love general practice, but I want something a little more, what I thought was challenging. Not that general practice doesn't have its unique challenges, but emergency really interested me. Like the specialties kind of were what I was wanting to get into. And I went to a kind of a mixed practice. So it was routine appointments plus emergency. And I did that for about a year. And then I was like, you know, I really want to like do those crazy things like cardiac surgeries. And, you know, I want to be in it. And so I applied for a surgery tech position. And this was like 3 years into my career, at VetMed in Arizona, which is, it's kind of like the Blue Pearl specialties, but it's locally owned. And,
okay.
But we had two cardiologists, three surgeons, four internists. They have a dermatologist now. I mean, it was a huge busy practice and a full ER. It was constantly full. And so I joined the surgery team there and I started working strictly in surgery and anesthesia. And we were doing some stuff that terrified me when I first got there. I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to cut this dog's chest open. Like, this is what they do. And like, you read about this in textbooks, you don't do it. And so it was really intimidating, but you know, I had really good technicians that had been there for a while that taught me, you know, they really made me feel comfortable with that. And they gave me the resources I needed to feel comfortable. And, you know, I did that for like 3 years, and I would pick up ER shifts from time to time or internal medicine shifts just to help out. But surgery and anesthesia was where it was at. And I was going for my VTS in anesthesia when one day the clinic owner was an ultrasonographer and he would go to the Phoenix Zoo and do ultrasounds for them from time to time, kind of like he would donate his services. And he would take us techs as like a special treat every once in a while, just like come along and set up his equipment and stuff and just get to watch. And I went one day and I was like, oh, we're going to do a tiger or something cool, you know, something that's like one of those like charismatic animals. And it was a little tiny golden tamarin and then little tiny kinkajou. And at first I was like, oh man, these are kind of boring. it wasn't like, you know, you don't see like the big 500-pound lion on the table. But as I was in there watching, you know, I was first kind of looking around like, wow, they have a full hospital here with zoo doctors that are specialists. And then the technician, her name's Ryan, she was there. She was just working with each of these species under anesthesia and doing the technical stuff with them, setting catheters and things. And I was just, my mind was blown. And I was like, wow, she is moving from one species to the next. And she knows what she's doing with each one. You know, it really made me like, I was just really fascinated with what she was doing. And after it was all over, I was kind of talking to her and I was like, so can I come back and help? Like,
I'm hooked.
I will sweep the floor or I will clean everything in the hospital. Like, have me do the dirty work. And she was like, yeah, let's have you come back and work with us one day and we'll see how the fit is. And so I came back and I was just so stoked that, you know, I went back and they were like, oh, we're going to go draw blood on a lemur. So how about you do that? And I was like, oh, okay. And so, you know, we did that and I ended up volunteering, I think it was like 750 hours before there was an opening, and that's when I kind of made the jump from anesthesia. But in the meantime, I was working at the specialty practice, like 60 hours a week. We were a 24-hour on-call surgery service. So I was doing that, and then on my days off, I would go into the zoo for 8 or 9 hours, or sometimes longer than that. If there was an emergency, I would stay and help. And while I was doing that kind of volunteer aspect, I got to know their head vet, Dr. Gary West, really well. And he would always joke like, oh, are you going to call in sick and come run this anesthesia for us? And, you know, I think he saw that anesthesia was a passion of mine and really let me do a lot as a volunteer, always having, of course, them watching what I was doing.
Sure, right.
But it really like took my love of anesthesia from this dog and cat aspect to there's a whole other world of it. So I worked at the Phoenix Zoo for 6 months, and then kind of life changes happened, and I ended up applying at the Oklahoma City Zoo when they had an opening in 2018, and I got hired there, and I packed up my car and drove out, didn't know anybody. And I worked there for 2 years, and I think that's where things really, really took off for me as far as contributing to the field and really gunning for my BTS in zoo. Just the sheer number of exams we did, the type of medicine we were doing, there wasn't a day that I wasn't putting some new skill to use, or we did routine exams on every animal. So every year, lions, tigers, great apes, you know, it wasn't reactive medicine at all. It was very proactive. And I think it just, I really fell in love with it working there, even more so than I already had. So after a while, I kind of felt like Oklahoma, the city, wasn't so much for me anymore. And so nothing against it. It just, I have some great friends there. I was like, you know, I really want to get out there and help a smaller zoo. You know, I want to be a part of that program where the vet isn't there every day and the technicians are really relied upon, and put the skills I learned here at Oklahoma into practice and even further. And so I applied at Henry Vilas Zoo and got hired and came out. And, you know, we work with the University of Wisconsin's vet school. Their zoo vets do our vet care. So we have access to all of those specialists, all of that amazing medicine they do there, and we can utilize that at the zoo as well. So that's kind of where I'm at now. And yeah, the abridged version.
That's super cool. One thing I've always heard, and it sounds like it was kind of in there for you as well, getting into zoo medicine and kind of starting out, just because there aren't nearly as many zoos as there are vet clinics around. It sounds like it's not necessarily maybe hard to break into or like a who you know situation, but you kind of have to volunteer there for a little while and just kind of wait for a spot to open up. Is that pretty common?
Yeah, I think that's really common, just because the skill set that you have to either have going into it or be able to develop is really complex. And so zoos want to make sure they're really picky about who they hire. You don't have to have ever worked at a zoo to get hired at one, but you need to have the personality, I think, is a big factor to where you're, you know, be teachable. Zoo vets love to teach people things. And so it's really, if you can just ask, you know, that's kind of what I tell people sometimes, where they go, how'd you do it? I'm like, well, I asked, you know, I said, can I come help? And it was kind of as easy as that. So I think people get intimidated by the fact that it's such a small community of people working in zoos.
Sure.
But I mean, the resources are there. The Association of Zoo Vet Techs website has post internships that different zoos have, where you can do them while you're in school or as part of your graduation, you know, your externship hours and stuff. So the resources are there, and, you know, you just have to kind of know where to look. It's not so much who you know, but like where you know.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, it's cool.
Nice.
You know, I, as a teacher, I'm teaching vet tech students, and I try to open their eyes to, you can do more than just work at a general practice. You can work at an emergency place. You can work with lab animals. Zoo medicine is not really something that I really touch on too much. Like, the diversity of species that we see in school is, I mean, we go do blood draws on horses and cattle. That's probably the extent of it. So to prepare them for what could possibly be out there for them, what are some of the major differences that you see being a technician at a zoo versus being a technician at either emergency practice or a general practice like Banfield? What's some of the major differences that you see, other than the variation in species?
Yeah, I think that we deal with, not, I don't want to say deal, we interact with a different type of, like, the way I think about it is the zookeepers are our clients, so to speak. So when you've got a client or, you know, our zookeepers, there's a different relationship, a working relationship. So I think that's a big difference. And, you know, you're not just like, you're working as a team to figure out what you need to do to take care of these animals. You're working with not just the doctor, you're working with a zookeeper, a curator, you know, people in management. And it can be a little shocking at first of how many people are involved in decisions. Whereas like at a small animal clinic, it's like, okay, I'm going to go to the ER doctor and ask them what drugs they want. At a zoo, it's okay, we have this immobilization in 2 weeks. We need to figure out, do we have a way to get that animal to the hospital? Do we have the amount of people we need to lift that animal? Do we have all the equipment that we need? So there's a lot more checks that go into it, you know, whereas at an emergency clinic or a small animal clinic, you've got your kind of triage station with like an oxygen mask, and it's going to work for everything that's there. In zoo medicine, we have to make things for animals specifically. And so I think there's a lot more of that type of thing, where we need to really critically assess the patient we're working with, not just from their physiology, but where are they going to go when they wake up? Can we be with them? Are they protected contact? Can they kill us? Sort of thing. So I think those are the main differences.
A lot of logistics.
Yeah.
Yeah, logistics and the environment, kind of levels of people involved, because everyone has a stake in these animals being as valuable as they are, you know.
You mentioned equipment in there and how you kind of have to, for lack of a better term, MacGyver stuff. Is there like supplies that are more suited for species that you guys are seeing, or do you really have to create and figure out how to use a endotracheal tube for something that size? Is that something you guys have to try to figure out, or is there equipment that's available to you?
It depends on the animal. So with birds, there's some companies that make special bird anesthesia masks, you know, so the more common things. But when we talk about something like an elephant that's having an immobilization, you need to ventilate them somehow. And, you know, so that's where it comes into how are we going to take this common thing in dogs and cats and translate it to an elephant. And
I imagine you can't just squeeze the bag, right?
Yeah. And you know, the cool thing with elephants is that there's a doctor, a zoo vet, that designed a special like demand valve for large megavertebrates like that. So it's kind of like a weed blower, you know, those, things that you,
Like a leaf blower.
Leaf blower. See, I can't even think of common stuff like that. And he rigged it to where you hook an oxygen line up to it, and it's unidirectional, and you can hook it up to an endotracheal tube of an intubated elephant and basically blast enough force of air to inflate their lungs, because their lungs are like as big as a small car. Yeah. You know.
Oh my gosh.
And dang. So that's a special thing that he had to develop for zoo medicine specifically. And like the endotracheal tubes, even the elephant ones are like 6 feet long. Can fit like a adult fist through the center. So there's things that are definitely made specifically for the species we're working with. And usually they're made from our own kind of rudimentary designs. And then if it's something that has enough kind of like, wow, this really works, then you can kind of put the plans out there and work with places to make the fancy versions. So yeah, it's a lot of ingenuity, and
it sounds like
you said elephant ventilation in there, and my mind was blown, and I had a hard time wrapping my head around everything else. Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. When I first saw the machine, I was like, what? Like
yeah. And but I can imagine it's such a narrow field, or maybe narrow use, the ingenuity that you put into coming up with some of that stuff. It's not like you can necessarily patent it and get it to a company and mass produce it, because there might not be very many other places that need something like that. Yeah, like you just kind of have to do it, to make it happen once. And if it works, great, you can, you know, maybe revert to it in the future, but you know, it's not something that you can readily apply on and on and on and on down the road.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, the for a company to spend the time to make something like a professional thing is, and only sell like four, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of places are so generous though and will help us make certain things, but to mass produce that type of stuff where it's like at every even some of that stuff, zoos share things because they're so either expensive or just they didn't make a whole lot, so you have to kind of help each other out. And,
that's kind of a good partnership.
That's good. That's good to see. Yeah.
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 So in your current role, kind of take us through like a typical day for you. I'm curious, do you often work with the same groups of animals or the same species, or as an RVT, like in a zoo, do you just kind of go where they need you that day? Are you all over, or do you kind of stay, you know, localized to one group if they need certain things, or what does a typical day look like for you?
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, really. We do have a schedule. So our schedule, you know, we start the morning with this plan, and which usually lasts for about 5 minutes.
before in true happens. Vet med style.
Right. Yeah. So we have like a plan for the day. You know, the doctor comes in and we have maybe a routine exam on an animal that they're going to bring up to the hospital. And so we'll prep for that. You know, if it's, let's say, a primate, we'll make sure we have all the stuff we need to intubate, to set catheters, get blood, you know, what tests are we going to run, that type of stuff. And then usually while one of the techs is doing that at the Henry Vilas Zoo, we're also the quarantine animal keepers. So at a smaller zoo like that, we won't necessarily have a dedicated hospital keeper that's taking care of those animals. So someone will be doing that, making sure that everyone's getting taken care of and enriched. And then there's the lab work. So after the exam, we need to run the blood work, and we can send stuff out to a lab, or we can run it in-house if we want more immediate results. So if it's a bird, we read all those blood slides and we get differentials, and we, you know, check for blood parasites, and, you know, we provide all that information to the vets. And then, you know, things like filling prescriptions and machine maintenance, a lot of the stuff you would do in your normal clinic are done at a zoo. Entering records, putting lab work in the computer. So there's a lot of not interesting, like not fun stuff at all, where it's like, I will trade you a dog if you will enter in all my lab work. But, you know, it's the things like going out into the zoo and doing training. So we'll do different training sessions with keepers and the animals they're caring for, so we can get things like voluntary blood or voluntary injections. And that minimizes the stress of an immobilization. Or if an animal's sick, we don't have to immobilize them to get that data. And so it's really kind of all over the place and hit or miss. And emergencies, we have to be ready. So, you know, we could be right in the middle of getting ready to do a routine procedure, and someone calls and says an animal's not acting right. We've got to drop what we're doing and switch gears and go treat something that may be a completely different species. I remember once we were doing, at Oklahoma, we had a big chimpanzee procedure. So we had this really old geriatric chimpanzee that was having eye surgery. And it was me and the resident and our vet, like our boarded zoo vet, doing this procedure. And it took all morning. We had to, you know, switch from a treatment room and rush, take her into surgery to take her lenses out of her eyes because she had luxated her lenses. And like, we got through all of that, and I was just looking at the disaster that was the treatment room, like tubes and packages and tools everywhere. And they called and said, oh, this flamingo that we did cataract surgery on needs to come up to the hospital. And so it's, you know, that 5 o'clock triage, you know, everyone's ready to go home and yeah, the splenectomy comes in. It was drop what I'm doing, switch gears to a bird from a great ape, and take care of this animal. And, you know, so it the days can really turn into anything. But yeah, so long story short, we don't just work with one group. We're working with every species at the zoo. In some capacity or another. I already have most of the animals at the Henry Vilas Zoo. I already know their names and what medications they're on, just because we look at those records so much. And, you know, it's like knowing your favorite clients.
Yeah.
Mark, you mentioned in there the zoo vet. Is there a specialty certification that vets can get as well?
Yeah, so there's it's an academy, right? Yeah, an academy for like veterinary surgeons or veterinary interns, cardiologists. There's a diplomat of zoological medicine. They go through, there's a couple zoos and universities that have three-year residency programs set up to where a vet who's graduated and has done internships and stuff will come in and train specifically for 3 years to take the board exams, which is a huge test they give once a year. And then, you know, if they pass, they become a diplomat in that college. That's the word I'm thinking of. And so, yeah, it's just zoo. And, you know, they're kind of those zoo vets, man, what they have to know, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
like they have to literally know every order of animals. So, you know, not just I know about birds, it's I know about phenocteriforms, which is flamingos, or, you know, Xenarthra, which is things like sloths with fused cervical vertebrae. So like they have to know these orders of animals and all the animals that fit in them and what comprises the characteristics of these animals in order to take care of them. And it's, I wish more people knew about what they know, like what they have to know. It's so cool. Wow.
Hopefully, tonight will shed some light on it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's, I mean, one day at Oklahoma, we were doing, a blood draw on a tarantula and, you know, yeah, so we were training our resident on where to give fluids in a tarantula, and they actually have two body segments, and the back part of it is called the opisthotoma, and it's basically where their lungs and heart are. So that big kind of bulbous back of a tarantula, that's where the lungs and heart are. And the heart is it's a sinus, essentially. It's not like a chambered heart. And so to draw blood on it, you use like an insulin syringe and just kind of go into that little sinus and pull a little bit back. And they actually don't have blood. It's called hemolymph. So it's kind of a mixture of some components of blood with just fluid. And one of the interesting things about them is that it's not contained within vasculature. It's kind of free floating in their system. So it's what makes their legs move like a hydraulic system. So that fluid is pumping and causing their legs to go up and down like a robot kind of.
Wow.
And so we did that, and then like 10 seconds later, we're doing a rat. And the vet has to recall, okay, how does a rat's body system work? How does it transfer its body system? Like, you know, it's constant recalling of information. And they pass that stuff on to us as technicians, and, you know, it's constant learning.
There must be so many books there.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, the textbooks. Like, I have 19 jump drives full of textbooks.
Wow.
You know, there's one just for elephants, one just for giraffes, and then there's an invertebrate one that's 900 or something pages. It's all about invertebrates and invertebrate medicine. And so, yeah, it's crazy, and I feel like it's probably one of the cooler – I'm probably going to, you know, kick myself, but one of the cooler specialties.
No. Like, honestly, everybody always says that about theirs, and I love that everybody's, like, so passionate about their thing. Yeah. So, yeah, no, like, toot that horn for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, because they're so general, because they know so much, though, you can't, like, be a cardiologist. You can't be an ophthalmologist for these animals because it's just your brain, you know, would explode if you had that level. If you had the level of cardiology knowledge and experience that a cardiologist has, you know, and there are double boarded people. But so we rely a lot on other specialists too to help us with those cases where it's like, okay, I can tell you everything about this animal and how it works, but I cannot fix its heart. you know that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Surgeons, especially surgeons, just have that skill of being a surgeon that is beneficial. And so even like a surgeon doesn't have the knowledge of some of these species. When you put the zoo vet and the surgeon together,
right,
and they're working right side by side,
yeah,
you can do some pretty cool things. And then same thing with the technicians. You know, we get technicians come in to help out those specialists, and they're like, tell us everything you do, and we want to know. And then we're watching them work, and we're like, oh my gosh, like, how do you know all about these different, like, drugs and stuff? And because they use, you know, it's their specialty. And so
right.
It's cool. Kind of got off tangent right there.
No, that's fine.
Good.
No.
It's all good.
You know, you mentioned all the different, like, books and all the information and all that stuff, and I'm just thinking to the clinics that I've worked at, we've always had like a formulary of some sort that includes like dogs, cats, sometimes rats, and, you know, some of the smaller mammals. Is there a separate formulary for zoos that just includes everything but dogs and cats?
Yeah, actually, there is. It's the Carpenter's formulary.
Okay.
And it's not a zoo formulary, but it's an exotics. And have reptiles and birds. You know, what we have to do, though, is because they may have macaws, but they don't have Mexican thick-billed parrots in there, or they don't have Andean vultures in there, you know? Mm. So we have to, and that's where we have to be able to even take that exotics medicine and go, okay, well, I need to extrapolate this for this species. Sure, that's the dose for a 5-kilogram cat, but I need a dose for a 150 kilogram lion. And, you know, is it going to work the same way in a lion? So that's where, you know, knowing those orders I was talking about, like the families,
yeah,
where you can go, okay, well, these two animals are in the same family. There is published information on this animal, but not this one. So I'm going to take that information from the published one and extrapolate it for this. Wow. So there's a lot of that kind of like adjusting information to fit what you need to do, you know, and it's, that's kind of what we did with a gorilla we had. We used neuromuscular blocking agents and for some surgeries. And cause you know, you're not immobilizing gorillas every day with rocuronium and publishing that data that this is the evidence-based dose for this animal. So we looked at human medicine and we looked at what do they do in people for this procedure. And because it was a laparoscopic hernia repair, abdominal hernia repair. And we took those doses from humans and extrapolated them into an adult gorilla. Hmm. And same thing, we had an infant gorilla that had an inguinal hernia that we repaired laparoscopically that we used neuromuscular blocking agents on. And so we looked at children, pediatric medicine, and said, okay, what do they use it there? And how can we put that here? And that's what I wrote my last paper on, was kind of analyzing those effects and what we saw with the anesthesia and how those doses, you know, we had the idea for those doses and this is how they actually work. So it was really cool. And
yeah, wow.
So that's what we do with those formularies. We say, okay, that's nice. Well,
it's a good starting point.
Yeah,
it is. You just need the starting point, and then, you know, as long as you're careful and you are mindful of what you're doing, you can do things you didn't think you could do.
You mentioned in there, kind of alluded to working really closely with, you know, some of the veterinarians. And since you've spent time in small animal practice as well, how do you find the DVM-RVT relationship in ZooMed compares to small animal medicine? Pretty comparable, or do you notice any major differences?
I really think it depends on where you work and who you work with. Just like at, you know, in a small animal clinic, there's some vets that want to do everything and they won't let their techs intubate, and you basically just do what they say. Hmm. And that's definitely out there in the zoo world too. But it's also, there's also a lot of autonomy as well. So there's some vets that are like, you're a crack. Why am I going and doing that? Why am I going and guarding this animal when I can send you? It's within your license. You know what you're doing. Go give that animal a reversal and let me know how it went. Or, you know, so it's kind of a tricky line. It's still something I'm kind of adjusting to, even 5 years into working at zoos, is making sure that where I work is going to utilize me and I'm not just going to be stuck in a lab or following a vet around. You know, like when I worked at Oklahoma City, Jennifer DiAgostino was our director of vet services there. And she was like a dream, like all the doctors there, Dr. Cole and Dr. DiAgostino were like dream doctors to work with, because they would ask you, what do you think of this? You know, we did a red panda leg amputation on a red panda that was, I think she was like 4 or 5 months old. And Dr. DiAgostino came to me and said, you've done a lot of surgery and anesthesia on pediatric animals. What would you do for your, what would your pre-medication be? What would your pain control be for, like, she looked to me and said, give me your information, you know, show me your information. And I had never felt more utilized more valued than when it's situations like that, or, you know, where they send us out as techs out to dart animals and deliver those drugs. And, you know, I think that's what everyone strives to get to, is that level of, you know, and working at Henry Vilas today, I mean, I was on ground as the only vet staff myself, and I was relaying things to my vet via text and saying, this is what's going on. These are the signalments, how they're presenting. And she would text me back what to do, and I would do those things, you know, under her direction without her being there. So even in that, I feel utilized, because it's like, yeah, we can get stuff done, and we don't, you know, the vet can be out doing other things, and we can take care of these animals. And but not everywhere is like that. You know, there's some places where it's all focused on the doctor, and doctors are doing all the blood draws, you know, and I think that's kind of something we struggle with in the veterinary field in general.
Yeah.
Not just at zoos, is really utilizing our technicians for what we know and what we went to school for and what we're trained to do. So I think we're on the same, you know, we have those struggles sometimes too in zoo medicine.
So you're now going for your VTS in zoo medicine. I can't even imagine what you have to do.
I know, right?
even just complete that application and then... What's on your exam? So what does that whole process look like? I know Jeff and I have been through that process with emergency critical care, but I would imagine in zoo medicine, it's vastly different. So
yeah.
What's actually involved in that?
Yeah, it's so rigorous. And, you know, I started doing it the day I started volunteering at the zoo. I was like, I'm going to do that. I'm going to get that VTS. And, you know, the first thing is you need 10,000 hours of...
Yeah.
Experience, which equates to about 5 years. So that alone, when I was working on my anesthesia VTS, it was like, okay, here's the 3-year mark. I'm ready. In zoo, you've got 5 years before you can even consider being ready. And then even then, you know, sometimes you don't get to sit for the exam for another 3 or 4 years, just because there's so much you have to do or be able to do and know that you can't fit it all into to 5 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
One of the big things is the skills list. So it's a massive skills list where you're logging every IV catheter you're putting in, every endotracheal tube, and you can't put it in your log until it's not just that I did it on one animal. You have to say I am an expert at this before you can put it down there. So you have to repeatedly do things. Different types of lab work. So it's not just the tech skills. It's I can run lab work on 45 different species of birds and give accurate results. Jeez. Or I can look at cytologies from stingray and tell you, you know, maybe not to the level of a pathologist, but I can say, yes, this is abnormal stuff on here.
Wow.
You know, so, and different stains, what stains work for different animals. So there's so much to do. And I think I'm one of those people that's like, I set my mind to it and like, I'm ready to do it like the next day sort of thing. So it's been a kind of a frustration a little bit where I'm like, God, I got to wait like 2 more years before I can sit for this exam. but it makes sense in the long run. I mean, you really don't want to go into that with like, I can kind of do something. You want to be able to replicate all these skills to a T because you're going to be the go-to person. It's going to be you and a vet one Saturday night on an emergency mobilization for something. And you can't be like, let me get my textbook. And like, you got to know what you're doing.
Right.
And so there's that. There's you have to do 40 case log and then pick 5 of those cases for in-depth case reports, which are like, you know, they're pretty comparable to the other VTSs.
Right.
But the thing that's challenging about it is it's still such a young VTS. In comparison, there's less than 20 zoo VTS specialists.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask that.
That was my follow-up question. Like, how many are there?
it's a small group. I think that's a testament to how difficult it is, you know, in a good way. If you go to the website, there's lots of phrasing that's like, this isn't a joke. You know, not that phrase, but lots of, you know, that's the innuendo, is that the people that are these VTSs, they really are kind of experts at what they do. If you want to do it, you need to be as dedicated. And it's a little challenging because we're so new, there isn't like a sample test or like a study guide. They give you the reading list and then they kind of hook you up with a mentor and the rest is on your own. So, you know, if you're not dedicated, you're not going to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Dave, it's like I was thinking back to when we were studying and doing our VTS exam. I mean, it was primarily dog and cat, right? I mean, there might have been small mammal or a couple of avian things. But like if we had to know those other species and the level of depth that we had to do for dog and cat, like what Mark's talking about with all of these different species,
good
night. I don't know if I'd have done it.
Well, I mean, and like you said, the needing 5 years to do it as opposed to 3 years for us.
Right.
Like,
right.
I don't even know if 5 years would be enough for me.
Yeah. And the reality is in a small animal ER, I mean, we see birds all the time, right? We see guinea pigs, we see rabbits all the time. And like, we know those, like maybe those 2 or 3 things about those individual species that they commonly present for, but certainly not to that level. That's
right.
That's incredible.
Well, and remember lot of the questions that came up was in the study group, we'd say, do we have to know this? And the answer was always, yeah, we do have to know this. Yes. And I can't imagine the level that Mark, that you have to know stuff
it's kind of like you take all the VTSs and mash them up.
Yeah.
One thing, because we got to know parasitology, we have to know anatomy, necropsy. I've done so many necropsies. It's not focused in one area like emergency critical care, we're doing emergency critical care too.
Yeah.
As a part of our VTS, but it's in all these other species, and so I think that's why it takes so long, and why it really is probably one of the most difficult ones.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure everyone says mine was the hardest, but it's like, I prep for the anesthesia analgesia one, and it is no joke either, but
I was going to say that's the one that I frequently hear was the hardest, and hearing you say that you had kind of started working towards that, and now that you're working towards zoo, I mean, for me and my lack of knowledge of zoological medicine, I would give that one the cake for sure, just based on that. But it sounds like that one, as all encompassing as it is for sure up there too.
Yeah, and it's really cool because I'm almost kind of like pushing. I wish there was a VTS zoo anesthesia, because it's so like even the VTS zoo doesn't encompass everything anesthesia. It's kind of like the generals.
Yeah.
You know, when we're talking about things like using neuromuscular blocking agents in gorillas, that's kind of a VTS anesthesia sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so it's like, I wish they would kind of create a subtrack. You know how the lab animal research has the anesthesia one, like something kind of like that. But because it's still a new VTS, you kind of have to have your core thing good, you know, and solidified and all that before. But I think it's something to work towards. And I think, you know, when I'm on the Anesthesia Nerds website, Facebook, I get so many tagged in so many things like, oh, we're doing a deer today. Is anyone having it? You know, has anyone done a wallaby anesthesia? And it's like, you know, there's a couple other zoo people in that too. And, you know, we comment, and that, then the conversations get interesting because people are like, what? That's kind of why I started my zoo Instagram, because I was like, wow, people really want to know about this.
Yeah, stuff. For and, sure. For sure.
You know, it's a great kind of extension of that.
That's awesome. You know, amongst all these species, do you have a favorite, you know, species that you like to work on, or that you gravitate towards, or one you you try to stay away from?
Yeah, I got answers for both of those. So, I think big cats have always been something big, like a big interest of mine. The first zoo animal I ever worked on, like where I was like running the anesthesia, was a lion. And so it kind of always, like, they're just so powerful and like massive. And like, I walked into a night house of our lions in Phoenix once, the first time I ever went in there, and our male lion like was like a foot away from me, and he roared, and my stomach like I almost threw up. It was like just the vibration of it is like leaning against the semi, like it shakes you.
Wow.
And it's just so cool. And then when you get them under anesthesia, you're like, all right, tough guy. Like, but at the same time, you're still just like in awe of this animal. And sometimes you have to snap yourself out of it and be like, all right, I got a job to do.
I bet.
Drool a little bit later. So lions and big cats, but also, you know, elephants, rhino, like it's all amazing.
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm very open about this, snakes are not, I mean, if we've got it restrained and under anesthesia, let's do it. Like, there's a couple pictures of me intubating a king cobra on my Instagram.
Wow.
And I was like inches from its head and doing my thing. But if a keeper brings up a bucket with a snake in it, and they're like, Mark, reach in that bucket and get that snake. It could be the nicest, like, garter snake. I will think 3,000 times before I put my hand in there. It's just one of those things, man. Like, I can't read a snake. Like, you know how you can read some animals, and you're like, I know you're about to bite me, or I know what you're thinking. Snakes just turn on a dime, and
you just don't trust them.
Yeah, I don't trust them. They're sneaky little things, and that's what they're made to do, though. You know, you don't got arms, you don't got legs, you gotta
Have some advantage, I guess.
Yeah, you gotta have something that sets you apart. And I think those reptile keepers that we work with, man, they really get our job done for us, because they're the ones restraining those animals and putting them in tubes and doing all that so that we can access their tails or, you know, put an ultrasound on them. We're really reliant on them to do a lot of that stuff for us, but we still have to know it for our VTS. So.
Oh yeah.
Unfortunately,
at least in an emergency to do it. So snakes and things of that nature. Are,
gotcha.
Give me a macaw that could break my knuckles open any day. Like, I'll catch up an eagle, talons that could crush my arm, but a little tiny snake is.
So they really are nope ropes for you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Nope. Yep. Not doing it.
Nope. Ropes. And what's the other one? Danger noodles.
Danger noodles.
Danger noodle. Yeah. Who else is here that day that can do this?
Yeah. Exactly.
Other than working towards your VTS, how much longer do you have to go to get to that?
I've got 2 years.
Two more years.
Yeah, and before I can even send in my intent, and you know, I feel like I'm just so motivated, like. I know I'm going to have it in file my intent like the day I can.
Yeah. As soon as you're
eligible. But a part of me is like wants to be realistic and just wait. Like, wait and see, because information's always changing. There's always something new to learn. And one day I think I know everything about one thing and it's different a week later. So yeah. I don't want to like get my hopes up right away.
I mean, other than that, is there something else that you're working on? I know that you've written a couple of papers and you've been doing some lecturing. Is there like a conference that zoo technicians actually go to? Like, we have IVEX, there's Fetch, there's some of the other big conferences. Is there a zoo conference that you speak at?
Yeah, there's so the Association of Zoo Veterinary Technicians is our kind of, I guess you would call that our
your flagship conference.
Yeah, and it's massive. Like, I think it started out with like 13 or 14 people decades ago, and last year in Colorado Springs we had like 380 people, and there were people from internationally. And so when you think about the size of the zoo tech community and the size of what that conference has turned into, it's really quite remarkable. And I think we had 3 days of lectures technicians.
From so
8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And, you know, it's really cool because you just get all these different ideas that come in from other zoos where techs did things and they're presenting on it. And, you know, like there's an elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, I want to say, that the technician that works there is, her name's Eileen, and she's amazing. And she's a VTS in emergency critical care, and she's working with elephants. And she worked with their doctor to create a special kind of bandage for abscessed elephant feet. It's something they can get because they're so big, their feet can abscess. And she presented on this elephant bandage, and now people at other zoos are using it. And it was because of a technician that wrote this up.
That's awesome.
You know, and so a lot of awesome ideas, and that's where I presented. And, you know, after my presentation on the gorillas, I had a tech come up to me and say, you know, we have a male gorilla that's got a hernia, and I was just wondering how you came up with, you know, what were you going to do if you couldn't do XYZ? And so it created this whole dialogue, and it's just really cool. And we always do like cool trips though to the zoos, in the host zoo, a zoo always hosts it, and you know, just get to learn about how other zoos work, and it's always a good time going out with your friends from other zoos.
So it's
awesome.
That's fantastic. What would you say, you know, I mean, I can, you know, just hearing you talk for the last hour or so, I can think of a few things that, you know, you've brought up that I would already say, but what is your favorite thing about being a veterinary technician, and what is one thing you would change about the profession at large?
I think my favorite thing is that nothing is mundane in what we do. You know, even on the dog and cat side, there's always something new walking in the door, something for you to become an expert at, something for you to be a novice at. You know, it's never like I'm going to go to my desk and sit there for 8 hours, and it's always changing too. So, you know, I've had to learn to accept that something I knew to be true previously is not true anymore, you know, with certain types of things, and go, oh, maybe I didn't know as much as I thought about that, you know? And so I think it keeps you on your toes and everything. So I love that aspect of it. And teaching is another one. I love being a part of someone's education. Something that I would change is, I mean, we really got to get our act together as far as our credentialing. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not the only, it's, you know, there's a whole slew of people, but I think in some way or another, we've got to make a bigger push for that mandatory credentialing or even just credentialing across the board, because there's some states that don't have it. And, you know, when I came to Wisconsin, I had to actively credentialed in two other states, and it's like I had to jump through 5,000 hoops do this application. So I want to see us turn into more of like what the nursing side, human nursing side is. You know, they manage themselves. They work under doctors, but they're working under their own license, you know? And I don't think our licenses are taken seriously like that right now.
Yeah, that's true. A really good point. Yeah. It's a really, really good point.
You know, so I think that's the biggest thing that I would want to change is that.
Yeah, aspect. that would for sure be up there for me too.
Yeah. Mark, I guess the last thing that we have to ask you, and this is something that we're going to start doing, because as we were kind of listening to our own episodes, we said that, you know, the different people that we've talked to said, oh, I didn't really know that this is what I wanted to do, and then realized that I talked to an RVT and they kind of talked me into this. And is there one person along the way? I realize you talked about someone your first day at the zoo. Is that the person that you would say really influenced you professionally?
Yeah, I think so. Her name's Ryan, and she was a vet tech at the Houston Zoo before she came to Phoenix. And she was one of those, you know, she could do things with her eyes closed. She was, and you know, I've had a lot of people that have been influential since. But you know, when I was just a baby zoo tech, she was the one that was like, "You're gonna do this today.
That's great.
I don't care, you know, if you're scared, forget about it. Just do it." Like, she gave me, I feel like she gave me that confidence that I was no one essentially. You know, I worked at a small clinic or at a private practice dog and cat clinic, and she took me under her wing and was like, "I'm going to teach you. I'm going to make you what you want to be." And so I think I take a lot of that. And when I have new people that I'm mentoring, I want to give them everything they need to go where they want to go, you know?
Yeah.
And I think she really kind of jump-started that in me. And I will always be thankful for her letting me come back and sweep their floors. But she made me do some crazy stuff that I never thought I would ever do. And yeah, I think I really learned a lot from her.
That's awesome. Before we wrap up, is there anything, any other topics or any other, you know, messages you want to get out to anybody listening? Anything else we didn't touch on today that you want to talk about before we sign off?
I guess just that, you know, outside of being a vet tech at a zoo, we are so involved in conservation as well, which is something I probably should have said is a difference between a regular dog, or not regular, but a dog and cat kind of clinic tech, is that we are doing tech things, but then we are also going out on conservation initiatives to other countries and helping, you know, with tracking zebra populations or, you know, field tracking Texas horned lizards. I was a part of a research project at Oklahoma on elephant herpes virus, where I was running, me and the other technicians were running the samples. And so all that's going to go back into elephant conservation. And so it's a lot bigger than just veterinary medicine part of it. We're also helping conserve these species through what we do. And I think that's a huge part of why a lot of us do the long hours is, you know, to see these animals hopefully have a future. And so I think that's a thing that gets missed a lot is that aspect.
Yeah, for sure. I hadn't thought of that, but it makes a ton of sense. That's awesome to hear that's a large aspect of the job too. That's super cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. When I was at Oklahoma, our lead technician, who was a DTS, went to Madagascar and helped with the radiated tortoise confiscation that happened there, where they found 10,000 radiated tortoises shoved inside a small house, and they were getting ready to send them out on the black market. And she was there for 2 weeks treating these animals and getting them ready for release back into the wild. And, you know, so that kind of stuff is just, if you want to do those things, and when you say, "I want to go work with animals in Africa," being a zoo tech will help that happen.
Wow.
That's crazy.
It's insane. Yeah. So that's kind of other passion of mine.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. This has been, Jeff and I are just fascinated by everything that we're hearing.
Yeah, yeah, blown away.
Just amazing stuff. And
I'm still stuck on elephant ventilation.
I'll send you some stuff.
Yeah, send us some pictures.
Yes, please, absolutely.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts.
Yeah. Well, we're not done just yet. We still have our one last final question.
Sure.
So this is the Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question. Are you ready for it?
Oh, Lord, yeah.
Okay. Would you rather have teeth for hair or hair for teeth?
Oh, hair. Like, I just tried to visualize it in my brain. I feel like I would do the teeth for hair because can I wear a hat? Or is it like the functionality of the hair as teeth, I don't think I'd have to like.
Yeah, you'd have to pretty much subside on like a liquid diet, I think.
Well, you'd have to be like. Wouldn't you have to be like what are those whales that have the baleen instead of teeth?
Yeah,
you have to eat
krill or
yeah.
Yeah, like filter feed.
Yeah.
I think given today's kind of a lot of people are very individuality, you know, they're very individualism and like, you know, pride in who you are and everything. I think the teeth thing would fit more with that. Yeah. Like teeth with hair, teeth for your teeth as hair, you probably fit in a little more with the whole.
Well, and would the other question would be, are they going to be short teeth or are they going to have long flowing teeth?
I think my initial image is like Hellraiser with incisors.
Yeah.
Like that's the initial image that popped into my head, not molars or canines, like just incisors, like in rows.
Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and I don't have hair, so I'll take anything at this point. If it's teeth up there, I don't care.
Oh yeah, as long as I don't have a bald spot, it's fine.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. I'm just like fascinated and blown away. Just like with another path that veterinary technicians can take, and I know so many start out wanting to work in zoo med, and I know it's probably a little bit tough to get into, but once you do, like the stuff that you can do is so cool, and I'm stoked to hear that there's a VTS and some advancement there, and the education and all that is in place and kind of taking off, because it's as you were saying earlier, like the utilization and kind of moving forward the next generation that are coming through, like that's what drives a lot of us once we've been doing this for a while. So I'm really, really stoked to hear that all that is in place. And again, just thank you so much for your time. And
yes,
and
thank you.
And for letting everybody
hear
this. I'm
still stuck on the tarantula blood draw.
Yes, that too. Oh my gosh.
There's video of that on my Instagram too. So
okay.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
And you can see that.
Again, check it out on Instagram at ZooMedRVT. Lots of really cool pictures and stories and videos and stuff on there. So thanks again for your time and coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. We hope to chat with you soon.
Yeah, for sure. It was great talking to you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
And have a good night, everybody. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. We often talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues. As such, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by us as the hosts or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Lastly, as Dave said during the intro, please like us, follow us, and take a minute to rate and review the Vet Tech Cafe podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. It really does help. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.